Hadi bakalım.
The pretense is gone. We are an empire. And in fact, the current theory is that Donald Trump is just playing one big game of Risk. I mean, look at it. Look at the strategy here. He's obviously securing Venezuela so that he can control and secure the rest of North America and move his armies out, as you can see. There we go. We got it. That's the whole episode on Venezuela. You're welcome. That's all we need to know.
Honestly, I think we've covered everything.
Really? That's it?
I don't think there's anything else left to do.
Just makes me want to play Risk now.
I mean, Joe's already got his backpack on, so he's ready to go.
That's right. Yeah. I'm like, yep, good episode, guys. Catch you in the next one.
You don't have time for a game of Risk. You got serious things to do.
I do have to go. I wasn't even going to talk on this episode, but I had to.
You had to.
I had to.
It's just a little bit more Joe.
Yeah, Joe has to take off, so there'll be a point where he's talking, and then he'll just not be talking.
That's right. I am going to Irish goodbye. It's the song of my people.
Well, apparently it's a Great Britain goodbye, because you're just incorporated with Great Britain here.
This offends the shit out of me, to be honest.
Not cool.
The story of my people is a never-ending fight against the crown, and for them to just loop us into Great Britain just really pisses me off.
For audio only, we're looking at a Risk board, and they just combined all of the British Isles, and there's just land bridges between them. And no reason. We were confused about it before we started recording. And Joe was really upset. He's fuming.
Ouch. Red in the face.
Yeah. Red, in the face
red in the hair.
Yeah. Yeah. And also explains Greenland. Obviously, we're going to be taking Greenland next. That's it. All 400,000 people in Greenland, or 40,000 people in Greenland. Yeah, that's what it is. 40,000.
I think we need a new Risk board now, actually, with the Arctic at the center.
Yes.
Right? Because that, I think, is part of the, especially part of the Greenland play. Mm-hmm. Probably not so much part of Venezuela, but that'd be an interesting view, don't you think?
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah. All right.
100%.
Maybe enough on the Risk bit.
All right.
Moving on.
Operation Absolute Resolve took place January 3rd, 2026. So U.S. Special Forces, supported by CIA intelligence and airstrikes, captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores? Mm-hmm. Hey.
Sounds like a celebrity.
I said it. During a raid in Caracas as part of Operation Absolute Resolve, Maduro subsequently transferred to U.S. custody to face longstanding narco-terrorism charges.
First question I have is, how do we feel about the name of the operation? I don't like it.
Absolute Resolve.
It's not like Midnight Hammer. You know, that one packs a punch.
It does.
This one's just kind of like,
It doesn't really like it. It's kind of cool, Absolute Resolve, but it doesn't like.
I don't know.
It's got enduring freedom vibes. Yeah. You know? Where it's like, is this going to be another forever war? Is that what you're trying to tell us with the name of the mission here?
My case is it's looking like a forever war, guys.
Oh, God.
Let me explain why. Now, a lot of people are saying it can't be, but I'm going to make the opposite case.
I'm just going to say Midnight Hammer would have been such a better name for this one.
True. They just mix the names up.
I know. It's like bad name.
You think they just like draw two things out of a hat and they're like, this one is Pudgy Penguins. All right, Operation Pudgy Penguins, here we go.
Oh, there's penguins in the White House. We'll get that done.
And if you want swag with the Pudgy Penguin on it, you can go to Revved Up Promo. Go check them out. They make awesome stuff. We use them for our swag. Check out Kyle's cool hat. And you can too. Just check out revveduppromo.com and you can get your own awesome Revved Up promotions.
This is not endorsed by Pudgy Penguins. Put that out there.
Pudgy Penguins are not affiliated with Revved Up Promo.
So the first question that I had, beyond how Risk-like it was, is the legal basis. We have this interesting, and this has been debated since the very beginning. There's a lot of different dynamics to it, but I did think this comment from Marco Rubio was particularly telling when trying to combat the idea that this needed congressional approval.
This was not an action that required congressional approval. In fact, it couldn't require congressional approval because this was not an invasion. This is not an extended military operation. This is a very precise operation that involved a couple of hours of action. It was a very delicate operation, too. It was one that required all these conditions to be in place at the right time in the right place. You couldn't afford leaks. We couldn't afford anything out there that would have endangered the mission and gotten people killed or killed off the mission and the optionality. We didn't even know if the mission was going to happen. How can you notify something you're not even sure if it can happen? Because in order for it to happen, you needed to have weather conditions in place. He needed to be at the right place at the right time. We needed to have forces prepared to go. There were a lot of factors in place. It was a trigger-based operation. But you can't notify that, number one, because you don't even know if it's going to happen, if those conditions will ever align. But, and number two, you can't risk it being disclosed. But this was not an attack on Venezuela. This was a law enforcement function to capture an indicted drug trafficker. And of course, we needed the Department of War to support it because they do have anti-aircraft missiles that could shoot down those helicopters.
But will you?
We had to take down radars. We had to take down those anti-air elements on the way in and on the way out. And that's what this was limited to.
But will you seek congressional approval for any further action in Venezuela or the region?
Well, we will seek congressional approval for actions that require congressional approval. But otherwise, they will get congressional notification. And this is not an operation that required congressional approval. In fact, this is an operation akin to what virtually every single president for the last 40 years has conducted. The difference is that when it's Donald Trump, all these Democrats go bonkers.
Yeah. So just imagine you're at the Constitutional Convention and you're debating where should the war powers go? And, you know, John Quincy Adams gets up and is like, but what if we wanted to conduct a war, but call it a legal thing? And then, you know, we'd have to tell Congress, we can't put Congress in power of it. We have to have, like, the executive do whatever it wants, because otherwise, you know, if we told Congress, then people would know about it before it happened. So we wouldn't want to have to debate it if it's wise or not. We want to just be able to do things. So why would we put the war powers with Congress? Just imagine that being said. And then you have a sense of where we're actually at as a conservative movement. If what conservatism is, not just supporting whatever Republicans currently in power support, but rather as the maintenance of the state that we were given to us by our forefathers in 1776. If that's what the spirit of what conservatives are supposed to do, then I don't know how you justify that within this framework of, like, well, we'd have to debate it, and therefore people would know about it, therefore we couldn't do what we wanted to do, as if the executive existed to do whatever it wanted to do and had the powers to do that sort of thing. That's a good question.
I'm going to steel man Marco on this, because I do think that there is an area of argument there that exists of, if you are trying to do some sort of a covert action and everything needs to be kind of debated out in the public, it's no longer a covert action, right? That's kind of the difficult area where I think a lot of this exists legally, where it's like, because we're not at war with Venezuela right now. So there's no declaration of war that exists here. And that would be something that you put in the War Powers Act, right? Like, like we're not at war, right?
We are at war. Yeah, we just struck them with missiles. What does that mean, Kyle?
I would not call this a war.
You wouldn't call it a war to missile another country?
No, not necessarily.
So I think this language game is really interesting, because what we're doing is we're making the imperial presidency an official thing. We're saying the president can strike any country on the world at once if he claims I felt scared. The war powers in the 1970s were to be able to act quickly in the event of an actual aggression against the United States. That is the intent of the law. And it's being morphed into the president can strike anywhere on the planet it wants to, regardless of whether or not there was any authorization to use the military force. Now, if what you wanted to do this legally is you go to Congress, you'd say, I want an authorization to use the military force against the Maduro regime. I promise I won't invade, or something like that, right? And then you get that authorization. And then at a future date, you can plan this an operation of this sort.
Wait, are you suggesting, so the idea would be, We have to tell the world that we're going to do this thing, and then at some point the president has the justification to do that thing at some point in time in the future. Because, like, it's when I'm looking at it, if we're looking at a situation where, okay, now everybody is on alert and that something's going to happen, like, imagine this operation going and they're alerted by it, right? Well, like then we'd probably have U.S. service members getting killed, et cetera, when at this point in time you send in like 30 dudes to go do this and there's a couple injuries, but everything kind of worked out pretty fine.
In terms of the Constitution is interested in the right use of power, of which branch should have the power to do things. And if you give all the war powers to the president to conduct a war, because taking a leader of another country is an act of war. right? Because U.S. law doesn't apply in Venezuela. That's how sovereignty works. Venezuelan law applies in Venezuela. U.S. law applies in the U.S. The president isn't granted war powers, the ability to strike another country, unless Congress declares it. A grand jury can't give the president war powers, right? So if what you're, and this is just narrowly, relatively narrowly focused on the legal basis for it, but you're reversing where war power sits by saying, well, we need to be able to, if we're going to keep our soldiers safe, we need to be able to have an imperial presidency. And I'm saying, like, well, then we never get to debate whether or not our posture to another country is wise. It's a good thing, right? Now we have to debate the fact afterwards, hey, was this a good idea? Yeah, right? There's no popular will.
Because like the constitutional basis, okay, if Trump violated the Constitution in this, which a lot of people are arguing, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, impeach him, right? So go through an impeachment process now. Like that's now the constitutional basis. And if this doesn't go through, to me, like it's like, okay, this is constitutionally upheld at this point, right? If we don't end up going through that impeachment process.
I wouldn't say constitutionally upheld. There's lots of things that the federal government does that I think is unconstitutional. Yeah. But as like the people kind of misunderstand this point about the Constitution all the time, it isn't that it enforces itself, obviously. It's enforced by our ability, our fidelity to it, right? The things that we say is what it is, right? So it isn't made constitutional by lack of enforcement by the Congress, although you're right.
Kind of think it does. And like practically speaking, it does.
So,
like just on a practical
level. I'm talking legally,
yeah.
But I'm not saying, I'm saying that there's a lot of areas where that's correct, where the president has crept into new areas and gotten new powers, such as using IEEPA to implement tariffs without the Senate and without regular approval. And this is another example of like, and I think I'm not alone here in feeling that this is the nakedness of the American empire kind of got coming out. Like the Venezuela embodies that because this argument is so torturous. A grand jury gave the president war powers, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it claims foundationally. And that's not in the Constitution at all. So now we're extra constitutional, even more so than we've even been in the past. A new step of unconstitutionality to the point where are we still a republic or are we an empire?
Oh, yeah. I think we're in that transition period right now. Like everybody's always kind of saying that the empire is crumbling. I actually think we're entering the empire phase more so than it is we're ending the empire phase. Like, and I think we're seeing that just across the board right now, especially with all these measures. Like we're kind of in that Julius Caesar moment at this, and it'll probably be a several decade long period.
And it might be Venezuela that's the crossing of the Rubicon, to keep with the analogy, is that there is this moment where the president can abduct a leader of another country, even if he's not legitimate leader. I don't have any particular qualms with the claim that he stole his election or whatever, but it's the wisdom of it. It's the both are our domestic policy where can the president do anything he wants, right? And then second to that, the international precedent you're now setting when it comes to is this a just use of force that we can reasonably justify to maintain our reputation as a country that goes to war when necessary, not just when they want to, and goes to war for just causes. And that's a tremendous thing. That's why the war powers are supposed to sit with the Congress, is because then the collateral consequences will also be borne by the people who actually had to vote for the war, right? If this results into, we don't know what's going to happen. It was a very effective and I think a very cool operation.
Very
right?
cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very neat thing that they did. I mean,
new technology involved in it too that really? They won't declassify. Like Trump and Marco kind of teased it a little bit in their press conference afterwards.
Wow.
It was like things we can't talk about. Like, we shut everything down.
They use the saucers. I know it.
So I'm curious what that, the level of intelligence is pretty wild.
Yeah.
Like their intelligence was so perfectly done mm-hmm. and executed on that intelligence. You're just like, ooh, okay.
Yeah. And you can't really criticize them from the perspective of like, was the operation a success? I mean, on its own terms, an absolute success. But the question about whether or not it's legal shouldn't be lost in that. Like its coolness shouldn't let us hesitate from the idea of, well, are we a country that is a republic or are we an empire? Like, are we here to maximize the welfare of Americans, or do we exist specifically for the interests of a foreign policy consensus in Washington, D.C. to be used as tax cows for them to arrange the global affairs.
This is an area where I think you and I may differ, and it's an area that I've evolved over the years quite a bit, is there's a lot of arguing over what the idea of America first means, and that's kind of where a lot of these fracturous mm-hmm. divisions are dividing along right now, where I think it's kind of been memed into, we're just not going to do anything abroad ever, and any strike that happens anywhere is always bad no matter what. Like, that's kind of become kind of the meme of it. But then there's a lot of like, no, where I'm kind of standing is like, I think that, and I've said this many times on the podcast, I think that there are some of these strike locations and some operations that we could be doing around here that are net beneficial to us because of stability reasons in places like South America or Central America and the like, where I think that those things are still very much within American interests. Where like stability yeah. of that region, some of the oil stuff and some of the precious, or some of the... rare earth minerals and like those types of things, like all of that makes strategic sense to me, where like, and I think Trump kind of signaled this with, this is where the foreign policy was going when he symbolically kind of was like, where it's the Gulf of America now. Like mm-hmm. that is the symbolic thing, right? It's like, we gotta handle the risk board right now. Mm-hmm. And same with like the Greenland and a lot of the Canada rhetoric and things like that, is we are moving into a new era of foreign policy to me. Like, I think everybody's just kind of like, it's the neocons. It's like, not necessarily. Like, I think we're moving into kind of more of a, kind of like, I think you said on our bingo card, it's the sphere of influence yeah. thing. Like, that's yeah. much more the model that we're looking at right now.
I think that's
look at our bingo card episode. Yeah, we talked about it.
The ought is distinction mm-hmm. being that the is, are we doing that? Yes, I completely agree. That's where, that appears to be where things are moving towards. Although that's a double-edged sword, because in the international scene, that means China has a right to take Taiwan if we have a right to take Venezuela. That means Russia has a right to take Ukraine if we have a right to dominate Venezuela, even as we are going to indefinitely dominate them through threats and the use of force without congressional approval. This idea that it can be done and the laws will only, the new rules will only apply to us and not apply to anyone else. Now, it used to be like a patina on that, right? We would say, we got a coalition of countries to go invade Iraq, right? There would be an effort to at least dress this up in a post-World War II liberal consensus, but that is now fading away. That liberal consensus is disappearing as generations change. And then also additionally, just like Donald Trump's feature on this is, he kind of makes everything very naked. He just kind of says, well, we're taking the oil because that's what we're going to do. Yeah. You know, and that's, I appreciate the aesthetic of it. I appreciate, at least I don't have to convince people we're an empire now.
Yeah.
I can say that. I've been saying that since 2012. But in 2012, you can say it, people be like, no, we're not. And I'd be like, we have 900 bases in 180 countries. And they'd be like, well, that doesn't mean we're an empire, you know. Like, you know, this was a debate.
Nothing bad can happen; it can only good happen.
Exactly. So true, Bennett. So true.
So I appreciate the overtness of it. That is something I respect about that. But that doesn't mean it implies the ought, which is: was America first an invitation to become a regular country in a regular time? You might not remember this, but there was a time, Kyle, where we weren't at war. It happened. It was called the 1990s.
And we're not at war in Venezuela. Yep. It's also what I'm saying.
We committed an like, act of war. So and I would just make this point.
We committed an aggressive action, sure. But like, we're not at war. This isn't like an ongoing thing at the moment. It could be. It could become that.
But
at this point in time, it's not.
Let's talk about that. So, we'll return on that. But I do want to let you look at the Politico article. When we get around to that, I'm going to make this point that while... this is more similar to the actions that we did in Yugoslavia or the actions that we did in Syria, where mm-hmm. we do a strike and then we're like back off and we use threats and covert ops. Mm-hmm. That is still an act of war. And the reason why is because it has effects in the world like a war. And when you bomb people, it's war. That's a military power. You're using the U.S. military to do something overseas to another country. If that's not war... There's like a almost like a woke like redefinition going on, where it's like it's not gender, it's sexuality, or that's sexuality, not gender. It's
I actually think you're broadening the horizon too much. Like when I picture the word war, I think of it being like this long standing, like and it could be 7 days, it could be whatever, but like I see this as an attack. Like it is, yes, it's an aggressive action. Like we could argue the semantics on the wording of act of war, but like it doesn't mean that we are now currently in a war. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay. Like, so committing acts of war does not mean you're in a war.
We are not in a war right now. Like we're not doing continual bombardments or anything like that.
I don't
think
the word war ever meant prior to, I don't know, somewhere around 20 Obama, maybe?
Like, I'd consider it more like a battle or something like that, rather than a war.
A battle is something that happens in a war.
These are like annoying semantics that's causing a lot of online drama.
And that's why you're pushing me back on my saying that this is an act of war.
Yeah.
We don't require congressional declarations of war to do acts of war. And I'm saying that is the rhetorical manipulation, not that something that prior to Obama or maybe even late Bush would have been considered by almost everyone to be an act of war. Does that make sense? So like when we act in warlike fashion, it's war. What I mean?
Well, because like my opinion is like I'm actually completely fine with the Maduro thing, with the kidnapping of Maduro.
Okay.
Like, I'm fine with it. What I would not be fine with is if this turned into some sort of major escalation that was like, now we're both firing back at each other for a long period of time and this like extended period and things like that. Like that's where I would not be okay with it. And I would be like, okay, these actions were bad, but right now I'm not seeing that future and where I'm like completely comfortable with the Maduro thing.
As long as the ends justify the means has been the argument, right? As long as it's not a forever war, then it's okay. Well, my case is that
even if it was like a 1 year war, I'd be kind of like, oh, gross.
Yeah, like, right. Like, a protracted battle with another country. We could, obviously you can do that and has been done in other places, but the long-term effects are that in international diplomacy would be such that it needs to be confirmed by the Senate because we're a republic, not an empire, not a monarchy. We're a republic. And we lose that function of government.
Sure, I'm just saying, like, those are nice words and things like that. Like,
well, let me define the words. If the rule of law means nothing, right, if the Constitution means nothing, then all that exists to govern us is power. And if you say, well, we've always only been governed by power, there's a sense in which that's true. Yeah, but there's also a sense in, like, what is the ought to that? What is the normative value to what is our ideal as a country? What brings us together at that point other than power? And once we're at that spot, it's the Game of Thrones, man. It's everyone out for their own.
It always has been, though.
Wait a minute. Well, yes and no. There was a time where we weren't at war constantly. There was a time in which we communicated as though the Constitution meant something.
You're conflating a bunch of things. It's like the game of governments is always about power. That is what a government is. It is a monopoly on force. So everything's always going to be about force and power. It's always like that's the case. It's just a matter of the logic of it and it changing over time and things like that. Like the difficult thing in a lot of this is because like if Trump went to Congress and was like, we're going to do the strike, and then it became a botched operation because they're alerted to it and all this stuff, like it doesn't matter. Like I feel like you'd just be kind of like, you're using this legal argument as kind of like a cover for like, you just don't want any actions to ever happen anywhere.
I'm just talking about the legal basis now. Yeah. I was going to get into next the strategic justifications, and then we could talk about the strategy of whether or not this was wise. Does it actually solve it? So we can jump to that if we want to. So the question of America first, like as you said, is like, means do nothing ever, or is it like a philosophy of empire, right? Like our foreign policy should be directed for the benefit of Americans, and we should exercise our empire that way, right? And that's there's
Is it pragmatically useful for us? Is to me what I think most people mean by America First.
Well, that's what the administration means. How many people voted for Donald Trump based upon his criticisms of the Iraq War, of the Afghanistan War, of Russia, Ukraine, were actually slightly more different than that. And that's okay to me if even I'm an outlier in that. But I think there's more people. There's plenty of people on my side of that. So we have this question from Jesse Waters to J.D. Vance on how Maduro, taking out Maduro, benefits the average American.
In Venezuela, how does that help the average American?
Well, a few things, Jesse. First of all, what it means is we're going to be able to control the incredible natural resources of Venezuela, which is good for America in a few ways. Number one, it allows us to put leverage on our enemies. Number two, it makes sure that if Americans need high quality, low cost power, we're always going to have access to it. And then the third thing is it does demonstrate American military excellence, which makes people afraid to cross us in the future. Some of the best ways that you maintain the peace is to make it clear that you carry a very strong sword if you ever need to use it. So I think it's good for us in a lot of different ways. We also have to remember, Jesse, this is in our neighborhood. This is not Iraq. This is not 7,000 miles away. This is in our neighborhood. If we cannot follow the basic principle, which has been a cornerstone of American foreign policy for 200 years, that we control our neighborhood, a lot of bad people are going to take advantage of it. What the President of the United States said is, in our neighborhood, the United States calls the shots. That's the way it's always been. That's the way it is again under the President's leadership.
You know, and I think that's a pretty good example of kind of the nakedness of the mercantile approach to thinking about America First, right? Mm-hmm. That America First should exist to benefit Americans by acquiring resources overseas and getting, you know, overseas companies to invest in America and kind of arm bending with the power of the U.S. government to benefit Americans.
Trade is mostly what most things tend to come down to. Like some trade and like the adjacent factors and variables to that. So resource management and things like that.
So the control of resources, I think, is particularly interesting because in the nakedness of that, because it's the mercantile philosophy, right? It's what drove the Spanish Empire to loot South America rather than invest in South America. It's the philosophy that you become wealthy by taking from other countries resources, right? And that itself has short-term gains, but long-term liabilities as a focus of your way of approaching the world.
I think that's overly simple of that take, actually, because it's not necessarily it's not about taking over the resources. It's about like the access of the resources and like how much it's flowing through your economy and things like that. Like it's not necessarily like aggressive or taking. I don't know. I'm not wording that correctly. Nah, never mind. Forget what I'm saying. No, well, I can't fully formulate that thought there, I guess.
I get what you're saying. There's a sense that what we're not doing is like literally installing a new company to run this thing with new employees. But we are saying you will take your oil to America to sell here or overseas later through what that is going to be directly controlled by the U.S. military.
Which goes into also the capture of that Russian oil tanker, too.
Yes. And we have a later on a clip from the energy secretary talk about that, which I think is very interesting because it is an arrangement. I mean, is it very clever in terms of we're going to control Venezuela by controlling their exports of their number one resource, of two resources, the other one being gold, I think is interesting. That said, the question is whether or not that is the just use of force, and two, is it like an international strategy that will benefit Americans? I'm not sure that the 5 million barrels of oil brought to America is going to benefit Americans in the sense that we want it to, meaning the thing that generates wealth is our ability to trade these things.
Then you got trade access there, though.
Well, let me finish.
Right.
So when you take it and you move it here, that isn't. I mean, especially because I thought we were. Are we opposed? Like it isn't. It doesn't make a lot of sense to bring in oil if what we want is more oil being made in America and exported overseas. I thought our trade deficit was the problem, that we don't export enough. Not that.
No, I think that's an oversimplification.
Hold on. Yeah. If trade deficits are a problem, it means less American productivity. Then this is less oil being made in America, sold to Americans. And I thought that's what at least a part of it. So there's at least that it's a short term way to subsidize oil prices, perhaps. I'm not sure 5 million barrels is going to be enough to really make that big of a dent over the long term. And then it goes into the international scene where we're controlling trade for the benefit of our foreign policy, which will have its own secondary order effects as people, look to shelter themselves from American foreign policy influence. Because now if you're an oil producing country, you are now have the sword of Damocles, the excellence of our military hanging over your head saying, you better sell to the people that we want. It's not just our treasury now that's bullying you into selling, right, or selling in the way that we want you to using American dollars, because oil was being traded in yuan, it is now focusing that direction that way. And the problem with that is that it comes with all of the problems of empire that is correlated with the control of that sort and mercantilism, which has innate, historical results.
There's a lot there. I'll maybe just kind of do a slight on the adjacent side of that. Is I was looking at Venezuelan markets the other day, and also talking with a Venezuelan that I know that is involved in markets. And it was interesting for me to see, because this is something that is unprecedented when it comes to these types of actions and how in their effect on markets, mm-hmm. is. The Venezuelan stock exchange is up 75% in the last 48 hours. Which that in itself is interesting. Like I tried to look for other precedents of something like this, and they were like, Panama went up 2% after an action like this. And it was like, and then everybody else is always down after. So that in itself was interesting to me. So it suggests to me a certain degree of stability is probably what we're going to end up seeing going forward. It's not going to be perfect.
I think it's demonstrated by their actions, right? There's definitely a focus by the administration to make sure that there's stability. That's why they chose Delcy Rodriguez as the follow-up, like the second in command to take over.
It doesn't seem like Trump really trusts Maria, what's her name?
The lady who won the Peace Prize, right? Yeah. And to what degree that was theorized that it was just because she got the Peace Prize, not Trump or whatever. I don't know. I don't really care.
I think she just doesn't really have the support, really. And
that's what they claim.
I think there's an aspect there where those types of people, like the activist types of people that are kind of, they're not going to be very good governors oftentimes. Like they're not actually going to be good executives. So that is the thing is I was talking to a Venezuelan friend who is no longer part of the Venezuelan diaspora, lives in Dubai in America, kind of on and off, and was talking about how pretty much everyone they know back in Venezuela is very pro-Trump right now, which in itself is interesting. But I asked if they wanted to come on the podcast and they're like, I'm still worried about the cartels. so that is just an interesting note. But where was I going with that? I had an aside. What were you just saying?
The stock market has gone up a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I lost my train of thought. Never mind. Oh, okay. I'm losing my train of thought, but it'll come back to me.
All right. I mean, Trump did say, quote, she is essentially willing to do what we think is necessary to make Venezuela great again.
That was my point.
A very interesting quote.
That was my point. The exact quote that I got was the leader, it's probably going to be a failure if we have anything less than Bukele. That was the quote that I got, that I received.
Interesting.
But then they said, and some Malay. It has to be kind of both.
I do wonder, and especially for South America, and what I understand of their history and their culture, that to what degree a large empire controlling what their government does for the foreseeable future will be met with a rally around the flag that is antithetical to this. I do think it's interesting. A lot of people are claiming, no, there's not going to be like that. They think something about them is going, they're reasonable and they'll be willing to deal with this on that. I don't know. Think about it for a moment. If after Biden stole the 2020 elections, assume he did. allegedly. If there was credible accusations that happened, China abducted him and made Kamala Harris president, and she promised that she would make America great again, would we then be like, oh, okay, I'm cool with this. I'll deal with this.
I think half the population would be and half wouldn't.
Which half would be cool with it?
Or, well, I guess in yours, it's then installing Kamala Harris. I guess if it was like a party switch or something like that.
But that's not, yeah, but that's very specifically for stability. No party switch has happened.
Yeah.
And it's only the threat that Ms. Rodriguez, we will also abduct you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You have no ability to keep us from
coming at me, bro.
Well, it does show, because at the end of the day, and you can like this or not like it, a lot of these kind of things come down to how good your defenses are and how kind of actual sovereign you are in the grand scheme of things. Because at the end of the day, everything comes down to an anarchic force between governments. And Venezuela has basically all of their military equipment goes back to the 1980s, and like they have no updates really or in anything. Mm-hmm. And it's way easier to just go do this in Venezuela than it is in someplace like Mexico. Like if we wanted to have a fixing some of the problems in Mexico, which is directly on our border, it'd be much more diplomatically difficult to go kidnap Sheinbaum than it would be Maduro. Right.
Yeah. And then even if you abducted her, would anything really change? Right. That's the question. I think that's the question that comes with Rodriguez. I mean, specifically is, will anything substantially change? Because she came up through the exact same political party movement that Maduro did. Maduro, before he was abducted, offered all of the oil companies to America, and we still said no. Now, maybe there's good reasons for that are classified or whatever, but we have no overt reason why those weren't accepted by the administration that I'm aware of.
Well, that's the concern that I have with this is, like, I kind of agree with my Venezuelan friend, is like, if we don't have a Bukele level of fixing crime and corruption in this place, we could just end up having, like the next leader really matters for the future of all this. Well, that's really what happened.
There was a New York Times article that specifically said one of the reasons why we didn't choose the other lady is because she was too hostile to the cartels, and that would cause a civil war.
That's the difficult thing about it, right?
Well, that's why we probably shouldn't do anything here. I mean, at least do it legally. But in the question of ought, why are we doing this if we're not really getting anything different? We're still empowering the cartels. We still have the same party in charge that had all the deals with the cartels. She herself is accused of moving gold around for the cartels.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly accused by human rights organizations. So I'm...
The whole Venezuelan government is just cartel folk. Like, it just has
so the degree to which this is for the American people, supposedly to keep the Americans from suffering from the terrible tyranny of Venezuela sending cocaine to Europe, I don't know what we're getting out of this, right? We're getting oil. I don't know if that's a wise policy. I don't think it encourages American manufacturing, American oil exploration. And I think it...
Why don't you think that?
Well, because if we're importing oil by force, that lowers the value, the dollar per barrel. We get less investment in the United States for oil because we can just steal it from Venezuela. If you enter all that oil into our markets, which is currently being chewed up by the yuan, that means lower barrels of oil in America.
I think you're presenting too much of a dichotomy there. I don't see why all of the above isn't a thing there. Like you can do all of the above with that. Bring oil price, like the goal here in a lot of ways is to bring oil prices down.
Well, oil prices are already down.
Yeah, we'll continue it.
But if you get below $50 a barrel, somewhere between 50 and 40, Texas starts ending. You stop production in America.
We can still
nothing bad can happen.
What's the current oil price right now?
After Venezuela, it dropped a bit to $56 per barrel, but that's before we actually get the extra five million barrels of oil. So I don't get me wrong. There could be short-term gains for the American consumer as oil prices drop for some Americans, and then others are going to benefit. And obviously, military-industrial complex benefits from this. But that's not everyday Americans.
But
and this has always been the argument for republic and for peace has always been that building mutually beneficial trade relationships where it benefits both sides creates that flywheel of prosperity where you get the right amount of oil investment, not government designed amounts of oil investment, so that you can produce and consume across these and then you get the both and. As long as you're taking and injecting, you're going to get secondary order effects that are a result of the central planning of this oil market.
Just on your argument on the oil market, I guess, because I think there's a bit of an assumption there too, that you're, that like demand is going to stay the same. A lot of the Trump administration agenda, especially when we're talking about like AI and stuff like that, is there's going to be so much more demand for just energy as a whole. So like, sure. so we need that. That's kind of why I'm saying like, we need all of the above.
Yeah, well,
when it comes to like, I don't think that we should only use American oil. Like I see no reason why not to also import oil, especially with how much demand is increasing.
I'm pretty skeptical now that we're going to be using burning gasoline to power AI power centers.
Just energy, all of the above.
It's not fungible though. Like your coal fire power plant can't be replaced by, and they don't produce natural gas out of Venezuela. So if it was natural gas, then you might have a case, but we're already one of the largest natural gas producers and exporters. So I don't see how, I mean, don't get me wrong, people will drive more if they are given cheaper oil prices, to the degree that that benefits consumers in America, sure, but also people lose. Texas loses, or Oklahoma loses, all kinds of important states. This is being done on behalf of, in the favor of Florida, at the deficit of Texas, you know, in that case, that oil price go too low, especially if the Glenn Beck thesis happens. Now, I didn't actually include this clip, but Glenn's approach is actually to think about it in terms of, this is in order to put pressure on China, right? So if we, and he says that if we get them and of all these other people on board to no longer sell oil to China, we'll be able to prevent them from invading Taiwan. Right. But the problem with that is that if you take all of that market out, then we are looking at $20 barrels of oil. That's a devastating to the American market for oil, because that means we're now importing all that oil to the United States, or it's in the international market driving the price lower.
Hmm. Yeah, I definitely think the China thing is, the China and the Russia thing is definitely like, it's the risk game, right? Like it comes down to it. In a lot of ways, the risk game is a good analogy, because that is kind of how geopolitics works.
If you're at war, right? And this is where the warlike posture is kind of a self-generating thing, right? Because if you back China in too much against the wall, are we not doing exactly the same thing we did with Japan? Right, so Japan invades Manchuria, does terrible things, not just fine. Japan, not a fan of Imperial Japan myself, but Japan's attack against Pearl Harbor was in part in response to us stopping being mad about them actually being an Imperial Japan too, and we didn't want the competition, so we shut down oil exports to them. They needed those exports, so they invited Indonesia, our colonial holding at the time, as well as Pearl Harbor. I'm not saying we deserved it. I'm not saying anything like that. I am saying that those are the conditions in which you back someone into a corner on oil. It does cause war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Ken, totally. It can, totally. I don't disagree with that. Mm.
So the next section here, and I do have it clipped out differently, Kyle, is demonstrative of how they will control Venezuela. Because I do think that this is insightful for kind of understanding how things are going to play forward from here.
I think this is the clip.
How do you control Venezuela? And we're actually seeing it play out in real time. The way that we control Venezuela is we control the purse strings, we control the energy resources, and we tell the regime, you're allowed to sell the oil so long as you serve America's national interest. You're not allowed to sell it if you can't serve America's national interest. And that's how we exert incredible pressure on that country without wasting a single American life, without endangering a single American citizen. That is called critical, high-quality diplomacy. We've done it. We've done it time and again, but we just did it in Venezuela.
Yeah. Thoughts, Bennett? Sorry. You just haven't talked today.
I know. Well, I've also been editing other episodes.
Oh, got it. Okay. But he's busy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I am the normie of the podcast. This is very much a lot over my head. I was just thinking, I'm kind of getting sick of Vince. Is just like, just says cover for all of it. Mm. And I'm like, this seems ridiculous. Mm. Like, say what you want about Maduro, but they are their own country. And it's like, no, you're near us. You have to just do everything in our interest. Like, I just don't like that.
Yeah, there's a power politics thing that I think is a little bit repulsive to the everyday voter. YouGov puts support for the actions at 34%, with the total opposed at 41%, 10% unsure. I think that's interesting that there is I think the new power politics has an appeal when it's framed as America first, that's going to benefit Americans. But even after that explanation of how it's going to benefit Americans, I'm not sure that people are going to connect with it. And lastly, like the use of this is means a constant set of threats, a constant set of war footing in Venezuela to say, well, you're not doing the thing we want you to do. So it's, you know, we're gonna have to come in and do something.
Well, there's an assumption that lies there. Like it doesn't necessarily have to end up like that. It kind of, these next couple months, I think, are going to give us a lot more of a inkling of where this is going. Like I think a lot of people have a lot of assumptions that it's either going to be the worst case scenario or it's going to be like the best case scenario. And it's likely going to be somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And who ends up being the leader in the future, kind of the Venezuelan perception of it. I know I saw a lot of polling done around the neighboring countries of Venezuela, and it was very positive. Like in general, South America seems very positive about it, which is interesting in itself.
Venezuela's lost 8 million people.
Yeah, 8 million people.
A lot
diaspora.
Of those are the surrounding countries. And I imagine that a lot of people in Venezuela are very happy about this. And I imagine a lot of the neighboring countries are because of the disaster that's been Venezuela. That said, in looking at the history of it, part of the reason why Venezuela is a disaster is also because of U.S. policy.
A lot of CIA activity. Yeah, for sure. 100%.
And Treasury activity to isolate them, and sanction activity to punish
them.
And all those kind of things that really made it the basket case that it was, beyond the communism, which made it even worse, right? Actually, we have a video that's actually getting a lot of views right now on TikTok about us just making a case of like, people feel like they have to make a choice between, is it the communism or is it the sanctions? It's like, well, it's obviously both. Like in every case, if you isolate a country and then they try to take that out on their own people by trying to create equity through lots of government force and corruption, well, it's going to make things terribly, terribly worse. One of the things that bothers me is people are using that as a reason why this is a good thing, as though that were the sole excuse to the way things are, when U.S. policy does play a tremendous role in the welfare of Venezuela because we control so many of the global markets through trade and through SWIFT and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, it just, when it, because like the way that I'm at least seeing it, maybe this is just the risk thing. Maybe I play too many Forex strategy games or something. I don't know. is when I am looking at it right now, when I'm seeing, they're right on the other side of the Gulf from us, and having this drastically unstable country right there causes so many just messy diplomatic, messy trade problems. It creates a lot in the same way, like even just Argentina collapsing causes so many terrible problems. And if we can aid, say, like Malay in some way by having these Fed swap lines, which everybody like freaked out about.
Yeah.
Just, like, that just seems,
we covered that a couple
that just seems like something we should do, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like not having Central America just being this godforsaken, like devil worshiping hellhole, which is what Bukele was able to kind of fix, at least in his home territory. Like if you end up having, in my mind, more Bukeles and more Malays starting to pop up, and like we might be seeing that in Paraguay right now. It's going to create a lot of prosperity in this hemisphere.
The question is,
which is very beneficial, yeah. I think, net beneficial, not only for them, but sure. also for us. And there's a mutual benefit that is like, okay, great. We can have like trade relations now. That's awesome.
Some of the reading I was doing today is the degree to which America is seen as the villain in that story, though, right? Like Venezuela is a problem because of the communism, but also a problem because of American dominance over the world to put pressure on them that then made them be the thing that they were. So can you create the problem and then try to solve the problem by military force? Or does that problem need to arise from within the populace to elect a Bukele or to elect a Malay who then implement reforms? Is it possible to create prosperity through the implementation of political force as opposed to from bottom up, where it has buy-in from the public to demonstrate how you can transform your society in a positive
way? Better change the voting machines in Venezuela then.
Yeah, right? Well, I mean, Smartmatic might be the core of all of this, according to some people.
But that is an issue there, where it's very hard without outside interference mm-hmm. to have those bottom up. Like Bukele was a bit of an anomaly. He won as a third party mm-hmm. in a two party system, which is kind of crazy. Like that mm-hmm. just showed how much. But he did manage to win, mm-hmm. which, and I don't know if there's foreign interference that exists in that. Maybe there was. It could be. kind of doubt it with based off of the posturing that happened around him.
Yeah. Know, and how much right. opposition there was immediately when he did win.
But also it's a much smaller country, mm-hmm. much smaller population, a lot less controls, you know, cartels just kind of maybe lost control there for it. Where in a country like Venezuela, which is a much bigger country, mm-hmm. You know, like I have a hard time believing that this wouldn't just take like a century's worth of work for them to be able to do it themselves without having outside interference. In the same way, like France came in and helped America become America in the Revolutionary War. Like sure. we probably wouldn't have won without the French help.
Don't say that.
I'm
just kidding. I'm kidding.
But like it's
yeah, it was like, important
it's,
for
it's kind of true,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like so, like this idea that it's just like. They should do it all themselves. They shouldn't like have diplomatic outreach to other people to help with their thing. Like that's kind of what I'm hearing when I hear this a lot. It's just like, I don't know. It's just not how traditionally the world's ever worked. Like,
well, I can understand a authorization to assist in pro freedom movements in those areas. Those are actually old authorizations that go way back to the Cold War. I don't think that is, I mean that, and that is something that the CIA is supposedly doing in these cases.
And don't get me wrong, a lot of CIA fuckery and stuff like this over the last, since like the 80s, 70s.
Yeah, I mean,
stuff like that.
What it really goes to is they wanted to not be controlled by America. Maduro and Hugo Chavez did not want to be part of the system, and they were isolated by that system. And then the people paid the consequences of those sanctions. And then people started to leave, and it started to really affect all the countries around them. And I get that those are all variables that aren't America's sole responsibility or at fault for. That said, plenty of countries change from the inside in terrible tyrannies as well. And you know, we don't know what would happen if we never implemented the sanctions regime, because we implemented the sanctions regime. We don't know that
exactly.
after Hugo Chavez died, there wouldn't be an opportunity for something else. I'm not sure that that ultimately we're going to see how this plays out, but it's definitely not over by any means. And the last part of the strategic rationale, we have this clip from J.D. Vance on kind of the goalpost, because keep in mind that the original goalpost was, we're doing this, we're striking these boats, we're doing this pressure on them because we want to end the drug trade to America.
If Americans love cocaine. That's the one big pushback I've gotten is when I criticize the Venezuelans for trafficking cocaine. You had a lot of people say, we don't like fentanyl, but some people do like cocaine. Unfortunately, cocaine is a very bad drug. And importantly, Jesse, it is a major profit center for the Venezuelan cartels. So if they sell a little bit of fentanyl, but a lot of cocaine, and they use that cocaine to spread and further their cartel operations, that means a lot more poison is going to be coming into the United States. So for all the people that love cocaine, I am sorry. The President of the United States does not love cocaine. We encourage you to go to rehab, and we're going to keep on pursuing America's interest.
Greenland.
That's actually hilarious.
Really funny.
That's actually
hilarious. Because the cocaine thing, like this was the problem. I had a problem with your argument when we covered Venezuela before, where it just didn't. To me, it seems more like starving out the cartels than it is about the cocaine.
But they didn't say that, though. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that's a sensible answer, right? What he gave just there, totally sensible answer. But that's not how they sold it. They said this was to protect Americans from a weapon of mass destruction, cocaine, that's being shipped to Europe. So we're protecting Americans by cocaine going to Europe. If they would have said this is done to starve the cartels... You see what I mean? You see the manipulation here, Kyle? And by
it's marketing tactics, right? Like that's what it is.
It's what's lies. Like there's a difference between a marketing tactic where I'm putting the best polish on the true thing I'm saying, as opposed to making a case that was always false, claiming that fentanyl deaths are the same as cocaine deaths, which we covered this and it's not. And then when we find out that most of this cocaine is actually going to North Africa than to Europe, that we're then saying that the government, it's okay for it to lie to me as long as it gets a net result that I like, to convince the rubes that they're not smart enough to know whether or not this is a wise engagement, and it can get congressional approval, or it can get, you know, broad support by telling us the truth. They got to lie to us, do the operation, and then shift the goalpost afterward to what it was really about all along, which is putting pressure on China, mercantilism, and, you know, starving the cartels of money, which, I mean, the last one actually makes sense.
Because that's the problem is I think somebody on their bingo card when we were covering doing the bingo card episode earlier was saying that there's going to be a civil war in Venezuela because of cartel control and things like that. And that's what
I did.
Was that yours? Yeah.
But my prediction being like things get out of hand and then there's a conflict potentially between like member of the military or the cartels who don't like American control.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of where I'm like, yeah, you got to starve them out. And one of their, and my understanding in Venezuela, the two primary kind of revenue sources are cocaine and gold. Mm. Those are the two. That's my understanding of it. There might be more, but there's a lot of cartel government cooperation when it comes to gold mines and cocaine that seems to exist there. And the gold mine one is the one that's actually more interesting to me than the cocaine itself.
Yeah.
Right.
But even this argument's kind of made complicated by Delcy Rodriguez and her background as she's been accused of actually being the real person behind the Cartel of Sons. And, you know, the Trump administration did have a New York Times quote that said, quote, "I'm not claiming that she's the permanent solution to the country's problems, but she's certainly someone that we think we can work as much as professional level than we were able to do with Maduro." Now, in that article, they claim that it wasn't until they got like to Delcy and decided that she was the pick that they decided to do this operation, right? So she is the hand-picked, according to the New York Times, the hand-picked leader of Venezuela, right? In the sense of like, if we didn't want her, we would have made someone else do it.
Yeah,
right. So, like at that point in Venezuela, she's now having to go around saying, like, oh, this is terrible, you know, return Maduro and all that kind of stuff, and kind of wave that flag. Obviously, that's not actually her position. She's kind of doing that so she doesn't look like a puppet. But everyone knows she's a puppet regime now. That what she's going to do is work with the cartels to do something different, to try to co-opt them into doing whatever the Trump administration is. But then it still has nothing to do with drugs in the United States. The thing that they sold it was, it's a war, Kyle, sold on a lie. Well, sorry, a war action, engagement.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with a war action.
We're bombing the shit out of this. Yeah. It's a kinetic engagement.
Sure.
But the kinetic engagement, which is a war.
I know words. Well,
the reason why I'm not wanting to call it a war at this point in time, and it may escalate into one, is just because I open up Twitter and what I'm saying on Twitter is, oh my God, it's a war. It's World War III. It's just like, it's the boy who cried wolf type of thing that I'm feeling with it right now, where I'm just like, guys, this was a 3-hour operation. Like things went pretty well. It's not like you guys are, it just feels like I'm getting exhausted with like the hyperbolic nature of like the war hysteria that goes on.
I get it.
That's what I'm exhausted by.
I kind of feel like this feels very much like that first summer after the invasion of Iraq, was mission accomplished. We're done, guys. Good work. As if nothing else were going to happen.
And that could be what it ends up being.
The people of Iraq are celebrating us coming into the country.
It could be what it ends up being.
Well,
but like not everything is the same thing.
I know it's not.
That's the thing. Like the thing that I'm kind of annoyed by is like everybody has these singular variables that they really look in, and everything is that variable.
No,
and it's just like the world's a complex place. It's multivariable.
Yes.
Like there's a lot of things that could happen here. Right?
Yes.
Like,
it could be more like Yugoslavia, where we don't pay the consequences of this until for 2-3 decades later. We're paying the consequence of Yugoslavia in part in our hostile relations with Russia. We don't know what the collateral consequences of this. This is why we don't go overseas looking for foreign monsters to slay. That was the advice of the founders, right? We try to centrally plan the security of the globe and it blows up in our face over and over again. Kyle, it works so great. All we had to do is give a couple people called the Mujahideen some money and some training, and they bankrupted the USSR. That would never have any collateral consequences against the United States. You know, I mean, like each of these, and it's, I don't think I'm being panicking in the sense of like, it's a warlike thing to bomb another country.
I see
country.
A lot of panickins going on right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the Trustican thing is
I'm not even being Trustican. Like I'm saying that all of these things, like all of the above could happen. And we don't know, like, there's just a lot of people that are like, I know, and it's the worst thing ever that's ever going to happen ever. Sure. Oh my God. Anything that ever happens, it's always bad. It's not nothing bad can happen. It can only good happen. It's nothing good can happen. Only bad can happen. Like it's just this perpetual blackpilling that's just like, my God, people, touch some grass. Like that's the thing that I'm kind of feeling right now with it.
And you think I'm doing that?
I think there's a collective consciousness in general that's doing it, and you are part of that collective consciousness.
Okay, yeah. So I think you're being a Etruscan then. Yeah. So I think it's
I'm saying
this time it's different.
You could be right.
This time it's different.
I'm admitting there's elements that could be right. It's just like the paranoia, like the crazy paranoia.
It's always an easier position to be where you say like anything could happen. And I actually agree that there is a possibility that you could have, there could be so much resentment to the Maduro regime that the changeover and Delcy completely rebrands herself and goes in a Bukele direction. I'm totally open to that happening. It could happen. But that doesn't mean I don't have values, right? I don't have to give up what I think is the nominally right position in order to think that other things could happen. Citing that something bad could happen is something that I think is worth saying at any given time and highlighting a potential danger. I know. Take ownership of what other people that you see on the internet saying. But I do think that the question of is this legal is a valid question, and is this a good strategy is a valid question.
Sure. Yeah. And that's actually the strategic thing is where I am the most interested in. The thing that I'm just eye roll every single time is just like, I'm getting just from anytime I open up Twitter, anytime I open up anything, it's just like, there's just this preachiness of the worst thing ever is going to happen. And I'm just like, that's not been the case for any of these things. And like in the last year, really, that the worst thing ever was going to happen. Like, it's just like, I'm exhausted. Tired of it.
So let me give you another one. Like, let me give you something that you could really support. So we have this hype clip from Nick Fuentes that I really feel like you're going to love. Dude, I don't like the message, but the clip is run really well. I want some of these.
Who are we to tell Venezuela what to do? It's their gold. What do you mean it's their gold? If they could defend it, can they have the right to all the gold beneath their feet? I don't think so. That's who we are, okay? That's who we are as whites. That's who we've always been. What part of explorers, conquerors, and pioneers don't you understand? It's who we are. The oceans, the continents, the moon, the stars. Nothing is beyond our reach. Who are we?
Kind of like it.
Yeah.
I know he's being sarcastic, but he's making some good points.
He's not being sarcastic. I think he means that.
I
think he's being more sarcastic with that, is he not?
No, man. I told you, it's a philosophy of empire. America first means...
Fuentes, though. Like, him, like his... I don't think his... I think he's kind of not for the Venezuelan regime.
Oh, he's totally...
A Venezuela attack, I thought.
Oh, he's totally in favor of it.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah.
I'm actually kind
of... That's my understanding.
I'm actually surprised. I haven't seen what he said about it, but like my mental model of him would have thought that he actually would have been against it.
So originally, my mental model of Nick Fuentes was that he largely was closer to the non-interventionist side of things, and the America first means that we should do less military engagements and we should focus on America and not be constantly obsessed with overseas entanglements. That doesn't seem to be the way he's actually is on this issue.
Interesting. Yeah. He's somebody that I would have figured was not for it.
That's based upon clips I saw, not based upon me watching the entire episode. I didn't get to do that. Although I did see quite a few from it. I didn't have the time to watch the whole thing.
Interesting. Yeah. Yep. I may have mischaracterized them then. It's one of those things where I would have thought, like, you know, you kind of had all these people in the internet sphere, and you're just kind of like, that person's going to be for it, that person's going to be against it. And I just figured he would have been against it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, interesting.
Yeah. And I think we're dragging a little bit, so I'm going to move on to what now. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, we got the Venezuela stock market. Trump says that Venezuela is going to send 50 million barrels of oil to the United States. All right, that's an interesting part of that because it's literally capturing and bringing it here. That's from a Russian oil tanker, amongst others. A lot of this oil that we're currently looking at for that 50 million is the latent oil that would have been delivered to China and other countries that purchase Venezuela's oil. It's now going to be redirected to the United States. The next one I wanted to look at was this comments from the energy secretary about kind of the function of this, as well as the political article we can kind of return on. This is kind of how this whole arrangement is now going to work itself out into policy, that when Vance is talking about this kind of sort of Damocles now hanging over the head of the Rodriguez regime, that this is how they're going to make sure that they're not subverting that through this control. So if you just go down to that first paragraph there, there's a, or sorry, yeah, first paragraph there. Do you want to read it, Kyle, or do you want me to?
Energy Secretary Chris Wright said Wednesday that the United States will sell Venezuelan oil indefinitely after completing sales of the crude current accumulating in storage there.
So that's the 50 million barrels. So yeah, keep going.
Wright said the proceeds from the sales would be deposited into accounts controlled by the U.S. government, flow back into Venezuela to benefit the Venezuelan people. Wright made the statements even as the United States the same morning seized the Russian oil tanker. Instead of the oil being blockaded as it is right now, we're going to let the oil flow to United States refineries and around the world to bring oil supplies, but have those sales done by the U.S. government. He said at the Goldman Sachs Energy Clean Tech and Utilities Conference.
Yeah. So this is the continued engagement of this, meaning that our the U.S. government will now be has now nationalized the Venezuelan oil company, right? Companies. And that's interesting, right? It's like it's literally it's not even that we like took them over and then like kind of in the, you know, corporate espionage kind of way, like moved it over to Chevron. It's now going to be held by the U.S. government. And I'm assuming maybe that happens eventually. But
yeah, yeah, no, my understanding is Trump specifically said, like I'm paraphrasing, but my understanding of what he said was it's like a temporary nationalization because there's already oil companies kind of coming in and moving in and stuff like that. Right?
That's not what I've heard. Not that there's oil companies coming in. In fact, there's a tremendous amount of hesitance cited in this article from oil companies to comment or make any commitments. And that's understandable, right? Because you don't know how long this can stick. Trump is only president for, well, I mean, three more years. That's quite a while. But in oil company time, that's no time. Yeah, exactly. In fact, I found one article from Reuters that suggested that it could take 5 to 10 years to actually repair the oil industry in Venezuela because it's running by the Venezuela's government. It's been so corrupt and so lack of maintenance that it's so degraded. It's going to take a very long time and a lot of money to do that. And then I found in that same Reuters article.
Actually, I just want to, before you move to that, I want to just say, I was talking to an oil guy about this actually, and he was saying exactly that was, it's such bad oil actually.
Well, at least the infrastructure is, the oil is relative, doesn't require as much refining as shale oil does. But Reuters also says that Trump floated the idea of using U.S. tax dollars to subsidize the reconstruction of oil companies in Venezuela. Now, this is one of those things where you do you take Trump at what he says? You know, he says a lot of things. You know, it's always makes it difficult to do commentary around him because you never know what he's
really I've heard like three about. Different things in regards to that that are all different things. Yeah. So it's one of those things where I'm like, I don't know. Like, I also heard like buybacks and like I heard
it's one of the things
stuff.
That make it really frustrating to be called a panicking because it's literally like, I don't know. I'm just trying to respond to what you're saying. And if you tell me that you're going to use my tax dollars to overthrow the regime and then my tax dollars to rebuild the oil infrastructure in the company country and then say it's stolen oil all on the same go, then I'm a little bit like, ow, you know, I don't want to subsidize it like that. That's not cool, you know. Like,
yeah, and that's actually to like, I agree. I actually would prefer it not being subsidized. Like, that would be my preference in this. Mm. I think that companies that want to go in this should be taking the risk themselves to do that. Mm.
Oh, and one more thing. The Russian, it's Russian flagged, not Russian. I said before Russian oil tanker. It's not clear that it was a Russian oil
Russia
tanker.
Russia claimed it.
Yeah, but it had a flag, but it had other flags, and it was just strange. I don't really understand that story. I tried to follow up. But
my understanding is that the Russian government has claimed it.
Really?
That's what I saw like last night, I think.
Oh, really? Okay, that might be it. Maybe.
And I saw somebody, who did it? I saw somebody having a clip. It's like a really like really ugly looking tanker, and they're like, I wouldn't claim it. Like, that's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah. So, in the last part of this, I think is really important for what now, is this dynamic in the kind of unveiling of the very very public nature of like America being an empire that could just act and we could just do things and how great that is Trump is now revealing his request for the 4-year new budget for 2026, a $1.5 trillion defense budget.
Let me pull a link actually. Oh, sorry, I'm pulling the link.
Yeah. I just didn't have anything else to say. Yeah.
The silence is deafening.
I have determined for the good of our country, especially those very troubled and dangerous times, our military budget for the year 2027 should not be $1 trillion, but rather $1.5 trillion. Yikes. That's a lot of money. We can't afford that, Kyle.
It's the biggest. Yeah, and well, and this is an area where I would be in agreement with you on
Thanks.
This episode.
Wow.
Is that I think that we could do a lot more slim down that would actually make things a lot more efficient, you know?
Not like, man, you need those military industrial complex bucks, man.
Maybe
you can't
you just
win
didn't
them.
Want our interest payment to be more than our military budget.
it's a race.
Yeah.
It's a
so
race.
You're going to raise that. Yeah. Just yeah. To, you know.
And when you look at this, it's like, you really have, this is inflation, guys. This is where inflation comes from. This is another $500 billion entering the economy where the military industrial complex benefits because they get the new dollars of spending, but not you. You get to pay the inflationary tax to justify that as those dollars trickle the rest of the economy, as new dollars entering in, those then dilute the rest of the dollars in the economy and make prices go up.
You get to
go f*** yourself.
Exactly. So Tucker Carlson has this clip talking about how he interprets this as the coming of a war. And I think there's a case there that he's making a prediction on that I think is interesting.
That he is hiking the Pentagon budget from $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion. Just announced that. Why? Well, it's hard to know without asking him. He'll explain. But big picture, obviously, that's the kind of budget that a country that anticipates a global or regional war has for its military. There's no other reason to do that. That's not a peacekeeping budget. That's a war budget, a big war budget. So I think it's fair to expect, and all the signs suggest, that we're going to have a big war soon. A big war soon. I think everyone expects that to happen. Hope it doesn't happen. But obviously, we're moving in that direction, toward a world war. Sorry. So how do you position yourself for that? Well, you look at a map and you ask the most basic questions. What areas do I want to control? Where are the trade routes? Who's got the resources? The president announced he is.
Yeah, something I'll maybe add to that, too, is because I think that there's definitely out of D.C. A recognition that we can no longer rely on the competence of a lot of our allies right now. I think that that's especially I'm always ranting, Europe, right? Yeah, and I'm always ranting about the Europe stuff.
Yeah.
Like I think that's kind of the and I think there's a question of like I think there's a question for a lot of people is just like, oh, they're just incompetent. I think some of it's intentional in Europe's place too. Hmm. Like it's like their intentions are good, but they're just not competent anymore. Like I think there's a lot of that happens in the DC kind of, you know, like policy wonk think tank foreign policy space that I was like, I don't know. I don't know if it's just a competence issue. And like, and we're probably rightfully being like hesitant with them kind of like, at least the Trump administration is like, I kind of think it's just, it's more of an intentionality on the European part.
Hmm.
And I think that we're going to end up seeing, you know, there was a lot of predictions on the bingo card about like the state of the EU and things like that. And not so much NATO, but I think that's related in a lot of ways.
I had one.
I think that's, we're going to be ending up seeing a lot of restructuring there and territorial kind of like spheres of influence with how that goes, I think is going to be changing quite drastically. And it's going to take several years, might take a couple decades, maybe even, but like that's all coming into fruition.
Especially if there's a world war, it could change very quickly.
Oh, well, that's when things happen very fast, if that is the case. You know, I still have my hopes up for on the geopolitical stage after resolutions in Ukraine that we end up seeing a lot more trade going from the Alaska-Russia connection and that bridge that builds a bridge kind of figuratively and realistically, you know, between America, Russia, and that solves a lot of problems. But who knows? Like, you know, the Ukraine thing is such a annoyingly catastrophic problem that it's messy. It's very, very messy.
Mm.
So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, imagine here that you're not having a world war this time with just armies. You're having a world war this time with swarms of drones and nuclear weapons.
Just robot wars.
With nuclear weapons. And how quickly that could get out of hand. Have it on both sides, probably. China has nuclear weapons. We have nuclear weapons. Russia has nuclear weapons. EU has nuclear weapons. Israel.
No, they don't.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm just saying that really risky. And
Pakistan.
And is he being a panican?
No. The panican thing that I'm seeing in people is that I think a lot of people that are kind of in the anti-war space, there's this masturbatory death spiral that is kind of a secret longing for war because it's like I can be proven right. Like it's very much it's Orwell's Road to Wigan Pier argument about socialists, where it's like it's not actually that they hate they love the poor and want to uplift the poor, it's that they hate the rich. It's kind of this like masturbatory spiral thing that's just like that's the thing that I'm seeing across kind of the online right culture right now. And that's the thing that is like, oh God, that's exhausting.
Yeah. So I don't think I want war. I think I'm worried about
I think a lot of people subconscious, and I'm not saying you do, I'm saying, I think a lot of people subconsciously.
Okay, so I'm not a panic.
Like, they're just kind of like craving that right
okay,
now.
All right.
I think there's a spectrum. It's a spectrum. We all exist
on a spectrum.
Spectrum.
Right. I just saw on the autistic right. spectrum, but I get that, you know, I don't know. I don't know if that's the psychology of it. Maybe that's where we disagree, but to me, when I think Tucker Carlson's interpretation of that is concerning, and we should really be thinking about it in terms of we have an opportunity to drive this a different direction. This isn't a situation where we can just act without any consequences. Every time there's a consequence, every time. And it isn't to do nothing. Like you said, that the opposition on this to these kind of actions are just opposing it to oppose it, right? Like they just don't want America to ever do anything. And that's not at all what I see in my position as being. It's that in my lifetime, and as I look at history, what I see is every time we try to be imperial, it has tremendous costs to the American people that are not foreseen in the beginning and are later paid. Because I don't think you can put that into the world and centrally plan it without consequence. I think the real myth, the real illusion is that you can do these things and there be no consequence. And it might be worth it in some cases. And I actually really generally hope it does work out, even though I'm a little bit worried that it working out means that we'll just do more of this stuff all the time and then we'll pay that consequence later on a more unwise situation.
Well, actually, I want to just add in there because like I think this is kind of what I'm saying when I say a lot of people are way too focused on singular variables. Is like sometimes these things can work and sometimes they don't work. And there's a lot of variables that cause those.
Yeah.
Like I don't want it to be a thing where it's just like, we should just do this to every country now. Or like we should never do this to any, like, yeah. It's like a case by case basis on a lot of these things. And I actually want to rebuff something I said is like, Tucker is being a bit of a panic in here. I was just kind of like reassessing what he said. That was the first time I saw that clip. So I had to like calculate it in my head a little bit. Mm-hmm. He is ushering this like it is a guarantee of World War III in the clip. And that's the thing that I don't like. And I don't like media personalities doing that. Mm-hmm. Is like this is not a guarantee of World War III. Like us upping we up the Pentagon budget every single year.
Not by
sure, 50%. Sure. It's a lot, but it's like these actions in Venezuela
what is the alternative explanation to suddenly increasing the Pentagon budget by 50%?
There's plenty of different explanations that can be had.
Like what do you think?
Like just in general, re-upping all of our general defenses. We got like the dome and like all this shit. Like there's a bunch
that's already paid for
military expenses. Sure. Whatever. It's like, there's a bunch of different military expenses of like, manufacturing new ships, like all these things, like these could be the justifications. And like, that could be for defense purposes. It doesn't mean that there's like, we're planning for a war or something. It's like, we know that war is on the horizon. It doesn't have to mean that.
I don't think it has to mean that. He's putting forward a hypothesis.
No, well, he's specifically said in that clip of being like, there's no other reason for it, right? And it's like, that's not necessarily true. Like, so he is being a panican in that sense, I would say. So okay. I am kind of taking back what I said there because I had to recalculate like what I heard.
Okay.
Right. But like it's not that's not the guarantee. Like that's the doomerism that I'm just kind of like, it could be.
Yeah.
He could be right.
When you
right?
say,
like, but I'm not saying,
I know we got to end soon here. So I think I follow you, but when you say that it can work out, what circumstance of it working out do you have in mind?
Define it in this situation.
A foreign intervention of this sort.
Of
where it worked out without any collateral consequences to the United States.
I think that this is kind of an annoyingly tricky gotcha question because
oh,
a lot of these things where it's like this is a single action, like, and there's going to be a lot of, and then this has to happen, and then this has to happen, and then this has to happen. Like, these could be, this could end up becoming botched because it's just, you end up having the terrible leader that ends up coming in or whatever.
Sure.
It's not like this singular thing, like nothing is exactly like this singular thing.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
So like, that's why I kind of find that is like, I'm not exactly sure what you.
Yeah. I wasn't trying to give you a gotcha. Get you. To be clear, I was not trying to do that. I was only thinking like, oh, he must have something in mind because he said it doesn't have to be that way. And I was like, oh, well, what am I not thinking of? Mm-hmm. When I think about it, I struggle to find a situation. And at least maybe the theory is, okay, so that there's been a lot of rhetoric from Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance this last week that's saying, well, Venezuela and Cernovich. Cernovich does, I think, a better job of this than the other two, honestly, where he says, well, Venezuela is not like Syria and Iraq and Libya and all the other examples of it from the last 20 years.
And that's kind of what I'm thinking. It's, like, it's not the same
thing. It isn't the same thing.
Right.
But what is similar to me is a human universal, which is that when you are attacked by another country, generally the incentive is to respond with, oh my God, we're being dominated by a foreign country. Right. And like, is that a human universal? Well,
and there's going to be some of that in Venezuela.
And it might depend on just how bad the regime was. It might depend on future actions by Rodriguez and the CIA and other organizations. We may really have perfected the color revolution and we can achieve that now. But I don't know. I don't know that's true. But what I have experienced is constantly playing the collateral consequence, right, of even what appeared to be at the time a very quick, short engagement that really didn't seem to have a consequence. Mm-hmm. It didn't bog us down into a long-term war. It wasn't Vietnam. It wasn't Iraq. It was Yugoslavia. It was, what was it, Reagan's action, Grenada, things like that, that didn't seem to pay a consequence. And some of them didn't really seem to pay a substantial consequence other than reputation amongst certain countries in the area for a time. And maybe this is one of those latter categories. I'm open to that. But that said, if this is all to put pressure on China over trying to protect chip manufacturing out of Taiwan through Taiwan Semiconductor, and that's really what it's all about, well, at least at that point, I really don't like being lied to, right? I don't like that. Sure. I don't want to live in an empire of lies. I don't want to live in a country that where they're telling me comforting little nothings in order to get me to support their war. I want you to tell me what it is for real. And then we could debate it, and you could tell me why I'm silly because I'm under concerned about China taking Taiwan. If that's really what it is, let's just talk about it there rather than this whole manipulation game.
Yeah, but the thing is, and this is kind of going back to maybe, and we can maybe start to close on this. Yeah. Is like going back to Rubio's original point that I was trying to steal, man. Is these debates being out in the air for the populace, like there's a kind of a reason why it's like a representative democracy versus just a direct democracy, is the populace's exact opinions don't necessarily matter because they're not the ones doing the negotiations and everything. And you have to keep cards close to the chest in any types of, like if it was a private business, like if you're in a private business, I see this all the time as an investor, because I'm very involved in a lot of my investments, and you kind of have like this tiered structure, and I kind of see the government the same way. This is where my existence in crypto has actually evolved my evolution and thinking of like centralization versus decentralization in a lot of ways. Maybe I'll explain that impact that at future dates, but you kind of like, okay, you have like C-suite at the top, you kind of have like core investors that are a lot more in with the loop, and then you end up having like the community with the tokens and things like that. And there's a lot of things that, you know, you want to be like, oh, we're going to share everything with all of you. But there's a lot of times where the population doesn't actually know what they want for like the given investment. And like the C-suite has to keep everything very close to the chest because there's competitors and all these things. So they can't just directly be completely transparent, even with their core investors and things like that. And there's like a certain layer of trust that you have to give when you're kind of giving your money. And I kind of see voting like that too, where like you're giving a layer of trust off to the people that you're voting for. And you're kind of trusting them to like, they're not going to say everything completely publicly because that would be retarded to say everything completely publicly.
Okay.
Because there's rivals and there's geopolitics. And like, if everything's completely public, like you're losing. It's like showing all of your cards at a poker table. It's just like, I got three kings. Anybody want to stay in? You're just like, no, you don't do that. That's why you keep the cards close to your chest. Like, that's kind of the thing where I'm seeing here, where it's just like, I don't fault leaders for kind of doing a marketing stunt that like over-exaggerates something in order to get their goals, right? Like, I don't really necessarily fault leaders for that necessarily, mm-hmm. because they kind of have to for the sake of the, and it's like, you know, you're looking at me like, oh, that's kind of like a terrible thing, but like, that's kind of how the world works. Well, you know,
there's
what I
mean? A difference between that and lying, right? Yeah. Yeah, like, there's a difference between overemphasizing and lying, right? There's one's a patina sure. of like using language to make it seem really awesome, and then it actually being a true thing that maybe wasn't as good as you said it was, or de-emphasizing the downside, right?
At the end of the day,
it's one thing and it's actually another. I promised you a golden pen. I gave you a pile of shit. These are different things.
At the end of the day, everybody's opinion is going to come down to, do they like the outcome of it? Like, that's really all anybody cares about.
Speaking for yourself. I think
that's how most people actually are. What? At the end of the day.
Fair enough. But I'm only saying that some people see it that way. Other people have values about what they think the country should be. Right. And that's where a lot of the debate right now on what America First really means. We can close on that.
I think that most people masquerade their morality to hide the pragmatism of, I want the thing I want. And I think that's what a lot of people do when it comes to kind of foreign policy debates oftentimes. It's just like, they just don't like this thing that happened, and then they'll kind of use all these justifications behind it and kind of use it and they'll moralize about it. But at the end of the day, it's just like, I just don't like the thing that happened, and I'm going to grasp for all these things, you know, and then the same in the inverse, right? That's kind of, that's what I think how most people actually operate. Okay. And I think most people are unconscious when they do it.
Well, there you go. So thank you so much for watching, guys. If you got thoughts on this interesting debate, please put your comments below. Let you know, whose side you on. Are you a panican or a trustican? You know, we're going to use those words, no matter how dumb they are. And really appreciate if you watched it this entire time. And please join the Discord, links below, as well as don't forget to check out Revved Up Promo, revvedupromo.com. They got amazing content or amazing stuff that they can make for you and your brand. We make our stuff at Revved Up Promo. You can too. Thank you so much for watching. Have a good one. Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.